we'll be kicking this off.
Thank you, please.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, welcome.
My name is Felicia Ng, and I'm a principal utility economist here in the rates department, and I'll be covering the first half.
Can you use the microphone a little closer to you?
Okay, then I'll be covering the first half of this 2023 load forecast presentation. On the agenda today, we'll be discussing our economic and policy environment, which will include the lingering impacts of COVID-19, inflation, and electrification. And then we'll go through each of our different sectors forecasts, and we'll wrap it up with some next steps. First off, for population, so here in New Grand, we have Stonehenge County change in population going back to the 1970s. In the gray, we have natural increases, and in the green, we have net migration. So for population growth in 2021, it was slightly lower at 0.8% versus the typical 1% that we've had in previous years. But net migration still was the primary driver in our county's growth. However, in last year, we did see that natural increases was much lower, which was likely due to COVID-19 or the recession. The population growth is expected to bounce back. Economists in our region are forecasting that the region will reach 1.1 million people by 2044. So if you take the graph from where we are now to 2044, that's roughly an average of 1.2 to 1.25% annual growth. As for unemployment, in August, Snohomish County unemployment was 3.4%, versus the Washington State as a whole was 4.1%. And between March and June, we were actually below 3%. Which tracks pretty closely to how we're doing in 2019, so that's pandemic levels. Just to give you a bit more perspective, last year around this time, unemployment rate was around 5%, and the highest unemployment rate on record during the peak of the pandemic was 19.5%. Here's a look at what economists are thinking unemployment trends will look like in the next 10 years. That's in the stripe. Bars. So as you can see, we're expecting to settle around the 3 to 4% range. So that's pretty close to what we're doing pre-COVID. Now here's our charts on total unemployed by duration of unemployment. So I know there's a lot going on in this chart, so let me walk through it together. So if you look in April 2020, that's right as the businesses began to shut down due to COVID. So there was a surge of unemployment filings, and you can see in that grayish blue category of those that were making up of unemployed that were less than 5 weeks. And that accounted for roughly 60% of them. And brown is about another 30% for those who are unemployed between 5 to 26 weeks. And in a smaller portion, the green here is those who are unemployed for more than 27 weeks. So the dotted black line is the average of those categories. So for April 2020, that was roughly 7 weeks of duration of unemployment. And if you follow that line, you'll see that it peaks around the middle of 2021 at around 30 weeks. And just from there, it mostly trended downwards all the way back to about 22 weeks of duration of unemployment, which again is pretty close to what we were doing pre-COVID. So one of the big topics that we've been hearing this year is, you know, our labor market, its shortages. So we thought we'll show a couple slides on it. Here on the chart is Washington State hiring rate in the blue, their separation rate in the orange, which was the big spike in the middle during the COVID shutdown, and then there's job opening rate in the gray. So as you can see at the beginning of 2021, job opening rates began to soar, while hiring rate just did not keep up with it. Instead, what we saw is that separation rate slightly began to climb up during that time, hitting a high in the late 2021. So a lot of people often refer to this time as the Great Resignation. And those impacts were mostly felt in the service and retail industries. So we have a case of missing workers. In the graph here, we have the US Labor Department's projection of where a labor force should be had the pandemic not occurred. And in the blue is where we actually are. So there's a clear gap between the two. So what happened to our workers? There's a Harvard Business Review article that published that attributed this dilemma to five factors. They call it the five R's. The first one being retirement. We saw a lot of folks opting to retire early during the pandemic. There's relocation, which is not so much of a factor for our area because remote work is widely available around here. There's reconsideration, so the reconsideration of work-life balances, care roles. We saw a lot of parents, and especially women, leave the workforce to care for their children during the pandemic, and some have decided not to come back. And then there's reshuffling, so that's people changing industries, often opting for less customer-facing jobs, and also people who decide to go back to school for hopefully something better. And then there's reluctance, so general reluctance to come back to work, especially in person, because either due to fears of COVID or just lingering health issues. So an interesting note on job switching, it was on a survey conducted earlier this year, it was found that about 64% of job switchers said that their new job provided more pay than the previous one, and nearly half of them received a raise of 11% or more. So this is just a very unusual time for workers, especially low-wage workers who have a rare leverage in this tight labor market. Remote work is definitely becoming a new thing in this post-pandemic world. On the graph here, we have a couple of major cities and the percentage of workers that are going back into the office. In the dashed gray line is the national average, and the Seattle metro area is somewhere between San Jose and San Francisco, so in that shaded blue area. So we're definitely lagging behind the nation in getting back into the office. And in fact, some companies are relaxing back to work plans as they struggle to hire and retain employees. Instead, what we're seeing a lot more is hybrid work schedules becoming the new normal. So, and that's something we're actually considering in our little forecast.
And like 5-10?
More like, you know, a couple of days in the office, couple days, actually at home, yeah. So inflation is another big topic this year. So what's really driving inflation? Here we have a graph in the green, gross domestic income, and in the orange we have GDP, or how much stuff is made. As you can see, they both take a dip during COVID, and GDP bounces back to its trend, while gross domestic income, you know, surges and surpasses its previous trend. So we have inflation because this is happening because there's just more dollars chasing a supply of goods that just can't keep up. And part of the reason is supply chain and production issues. However, we are seeing income that are growing so much faster than expected, while actual goods of production are just kind of catching up. There's also a different bucket of things that make up inflation. Especially, you know, here we can see the services in the blue, and that makes a big portion of it. And that would include things like your cost of shelter, but also smaller things like your Uber or DoorDash services, your lawn care services, and all that has been growing tremendously recently. In the orange is energy. I'm sure we've all seen the headlines on gas prices lately. Commodities in the teal is things like household supplies, like your cars, clothing, all things like that also being increasing. And finally, food in the yellow. So inflation can mean really different things for different people, depending on our individual situation and our spending habits. And we have a graphic here just showing just that. So if the average inflation in the US is around 8.5%, but if you're a homeowner with a fixed mortgage, maybe refinance rates were low, inflation could mean a little less for you, less 6 or 7%. But if you're a renter, you had to, you know, you have your lease in the last year and you eat out a lot or you drive a lot, inflation could mean, you know, 15, 16% for you. So very different impacts for different people. So what can we expect future inflation to be? One thing we could look at is the TIPS spread, which is the difference in yield between US Treasury bonds and Treasury inflation protected securities. And that's just the market's expectation of inflation. So this, if the spread is wide, that means investors believe that inflation will rise. And during the pandemic, you can see the spread narrowed to less than 1%. And as the economy recovered, that expectation for inflation began to increase and continue to grow to roughly 3%. So that's kind of the sentiment right now, and that is higher than what we've seen historically.
I think there might be an association between gas prices and people choosing to stay at home to work.
And now I'm going to pass it on to Brian that will cover our sector forecast.
Thank you very much, Feliciane. One nuance on inflation is that the experts, when they're looking at that, are not looking at the price of things so much as they're looking at what people are actually paying. So as Feliciane noted, for those of us who are fortunate enough to own a home and a fixed rate mortgage, well, the price that I pay for my house actually went down because I took the opportunity to refinance at a lower rate. So while the sticker price of my house stayed the same, of course, my monthly payment went down, which is going to offset all of those poor folks who are seeing big increases in the prices of their rent or price of the house that they've had to buy in this big run-up in prices. All right, so changing gears a little bit, now that we've gotten through kind of the macroeconomic conditions of the area and the country, we're going to jump on to the load forecast. What's all this mean for electricity? So the load forecast is an end-use forecast, which means that we're looking at how much we expect individual customers to consume on into the future. If you have a residential and commercial premise forecast, that's the number of customers that we expect to serve based on all of those macroeconomic conditions we just saw. And then we look at consumption per premise based on the most recent consumption patterns of new customers. We then subtract from that some figures based on energy efficiency, codes and standards, and climate change to come up with kind of a net number going forward. Our industrial customer base is typically held constant except for known changes in that group. And once we're done with it all, we try to normalize for expected weather, which is a whole different discussion in itself. So a couple of interesting things that we're seeing with housing stock right now. On the left, we have 2 3-year averages. We have our most recent 3-year rolling average in blue, and then our previous 3-year rolling average in the, what is that, light gray? Chartreuse? Does somebody know what chartreuse is? Beige? Anyway, what we've seen is a pretty significant increase in the percentage of new homes that are apartment buildings versus single family homes. The last 3 years, that jump number has jumped from about 25% of homes being apartments to closer to 40%. Well, the percentage of new homes being single family houses has dropped from 63% down to 50%. At the same time, of those single family homes, we've also seen an increase in the percentage of them that have electric heat. New codes and standards went into effect at the beginning of 2022 that made it substantially more expensive to have gas heat with much, much tighter efficiency standards on gas appliances. So if you look at 2019, 2020, 2021, where we saw maybe 25 to 30% of new homes have electric heat, really it's been more like 40% year to date. Note on that, we are forecasting over the next 20 years for all homes, all new homes, to gradually go to electric heat. If I could pull out my personal crystal ball on that, I suspect that Washington State will make that transition much faster than over 20 years. So keep an eye on the news for big changes there.
What 25 years changes? We used to help, I'd help folks turn to natural gas.
Yeah, that's right. It's a whole new ballgame.
Whole new world.
So some big factors that we have in our forecast here. Just a note before I say any more, the world has kind of changed on us in the last month and a half with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act and the new California CAFE standards that will essentially do away with gas-only vehicles being built in 2035. So this numbers you'll see here are significantly higher than we had last year and are significantly higher than we have in the current budget. So,
what did you say?
And they're also significantly higher than we have in the current budget, which there's a reason for that, and I'll get into the nuance.
I'll look forward to that.
Yes. So as I noted, Washington State is looking to ban the sale of exclusively gas-powered vehicles starting in 2035. We currently have about 11,000 electric vehicles in the county. They're now forecasting 170,000 by 2030. 660,000 by 2040. Our previous forecast, which was admittedly way too low, was 30,000 and 50,000 respectively. So an increase of several fold versus what we were expecting last year. At the same time, we've seen air conditioning adoption increase dramatically. Based on our most recent rate of adoption, we're assuming 65% of households will have AC by 2030 and 85% by 2040. For perspective, in 2019, it was 40% of houses that had AC. If you go back to 1996, it was only 6% of houses. Air conditioning in Seattle used to be a very rare luxury. But after last summer, you have to think that most people who could afford a window unit and didn't have a basement or someplace to escape the heat went out and bought a window unit.
I have a question about air conditioning. If we could know how many people are going to go with heat pumps, that would reduce the need for other kinds of air conditioning.
That's right. And this figure would include heat pumps, which is a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
In that not only are we getting that additional air conditioning load, but we're getting both efficiency for those who had resistance electric heat in the winter, but potentially additional load for those who had gas heat in the winter. There's a couple of different moving parts on that one.
Mm-hmm. And excuse me for continuing, but wouldn't it behoove us for more people to do that, to switch to heat pumps? It would solve both the heating and the...
Yes. And in fact, with the big new dollars that are available in the IRA, we are forecasting that about 30% of gas heated homes will add a heat pump in the next 20 years. There's big dollars out there for it. For those who don't have AC, heat pumps a great way to go and get a big reimbursement for it. So on the right, I did want to note that we have seen an increase just in general residential consumption, which we are attributing to hybrid remote work schedules. People are staying home and using electricity rather than drive to the office and use electricity. In addition to all those other factors, we have seen a 2 to 3% increase in residential consumption. There's no apparent reduction in load at the office as those offices have started to open up. As you might imagine, the HVAC here at the PUD is on and running no matter how many people are here.
I was going to say, it seems like air conditioning could explain that, because people are air conditioning their homes during the daytime for the first time because they're actually home. And the office still has to get air conditioned.
That's exactly right. My home AC used to turn on at 5 p.m. to have it cool off a little bit by the time I got home.
Yeah.
Now it's on all day.
So, we have buildings when we have a hybrid work situation. Folks maybe work at home 3 days a week or whatever. And we have all this space sitting here. Using electricity, and I don't know, to me that just brings another whole set of opportunities for us.
Challenges and opportunities.
Yeah, challenges and opportunities. I won't take it any further.
So some details behind those numbers. On the left, we have our forecast of registered vehicles here in Snohomish County. So let me work that from the bottom up. In the dark gray, we have last year's electric vehicle forecast, which was 50,000 by 2040. On top of that, in blue, we have the number that we built into this year's budget, which is already a substantial increase from past year's forecast. And on top of that, in the doppelt green, we now have our best estimate for today, getting us to 660,000 EVs by 2040. On top of that, in the off brown, we have the number of non-EVs here in the county, which you can see is decreasing over time as more and more electric vehicles become the norm to purchase. The math here is pretty straightforward. We started out with a 5% EV adoption rate, which is what we have today. And we've cut a straight line to 100% by 2035. So if you add up all those vehicles that get purchased in each year, that's what we have today. On the right, we have our housing forecast. In the bottom, in solid green, we have existing electrically heated homes. On top of that, in doppelt green, we have the new electrically heated homes. On top of that, in gray blue, we have electrification of non-electric homes, that's conversions going on into the future. In the peach color, the solid peach, we have existing non-electrically heated homes, gas or propane heat. And on top of that, we have new non-electrically heated homes. I'd mentioned earlier, there's every possibility that Washington State could simply put an end to new non-electrically heated homes in the near future. If that were to happen, that doppelt peach on top would disappear and become part of the doppelt group.
Is some of this driven by the fact that we have, like, in our service area, so many more apartments being built, which I presume are all 100% electrically heated?
They are predominantly electric, that's right. Okay, so the residential load forecast. Here we have in megawatt hours historical sales from 1969 to present in the solid blue. Going forward, we have two dashed lines. In the dotted black, we have last year's load forecast, and in the dotted blue, we have today's base case forecast. Two things to note on that. The first, and probably most important for the immediate future, is that the next 5 years don't look substantially changed. It'll take a while for some of these changes to ramp up on us. 5 years after that, though, we do start to see some substantial separation. And if you were to extend this out 10 more years, that separation would become more impressive. So, Commissioner, on why we've not updated the budget forecast on this yet, the reason is that answering this problem, solving this problem of additional load, is going to be a tremendous lift for us.
Yeah.
Something that we were feeling good to be able to update the forecast in the last month and a half, update our forecast of all the capital costs, all of our power purchase needs. We'll need to serve this additional load was not something we were comfortable turning around on such a short time frame. So all that is to say, more to come with next year's budget, but given that the five-year forecast looks basically the same as the budget forecast, we didn't think it was necessary to tear it apart this late in the game.
You're talking about this year's budget.
Yes.
Okay. You're extending it, telling us, showing us the forecast for next year's budget.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, what you're saying is over the 5 year period, there isn't.
That's correct.
Okay.
So over the 5 year budget period.
Okay, 5 years.
And make sure we negotiate a great contract with Buffalo.
Okay. So a little bit of nuance on that. If you looked at the megawatt hour forecast, well, that kind of translates into revenue for us. Our sales is megawatt hours. And we do pay for more megawatt hours, albeit less than we sell it for at the moment. Capacity, however, we really don't charge residential customers for capacity. And all of these could add up to be a significant increase in our peaking needs. So on the left, try to graph out what this would mean for us, looking at residential load only, not commercial and industrial, for our winter peaking needs. And on the right, we've done the same thing for summer peaking needs. So if you look there on the left, we have our 2019 actual peak winter day for residents in gray. That's based on all of our load research meters we have out in the field to give us that 24-hour load profile. Stacked up on top of that, we have additional EV load in blue. On top of that, new electrically heated homes, and on top of that, a conversion of non-electrically heated homes. So that's the additional electricity we need to serve those conversions. That all adds up to about 500 additional on-peak megawatts, which is a lot. If you look at the right, we see a similar scale, but probably a proportionally larger increase compared to our 2019 actual summer peak residential load of about 400 megawatts. Once you add in these additional EVs and our typical, that's 1 in 2 or median AC load in pink, or extreme, more like 1 in 20 AC load in the dashed line on top, an additional 500 megawatts of summer on peak load.
We're gonna work really hard to reduce that.
Yes, there. With this comes a tremendous opportunity to reduce those peaks. I have to imagine.
More diplomatic, I'm just going to say.
I have to imagine that some of the energy efficiency that
yeah,
we did not find cost effective in the last IRP will be cost effective in the next IRP.
Yeah.
Also, just eyeballing that, there's a lot of potential for time of day rates.
Yeah.
All those electric vehicles don't really need to charge from 5 to 9 p.m. To the extent we can persuade our customers to charge during the midday or evenings, nights, excuse me, we can shave a lot of peaking load off of this.
That's an opportunity.
Yeah, I'm surprised that the new heating is not more than it is. It's really an electric vehicle. But
yes.
We do have a pretty good morning.
I think that's probably due to our existing housing stock versus new housing stock being relatively efficient. And all of those older homes out there with baseboard heat, they use proportionally more power. All right, so transitioning on to commercial factors. Commercial loads have mostly recovered since the COVID-19 pandemic. They're about 2% higher on average than in 2021 so far. We've broken out total consumption by sector. As you can see, manufacturing has recovered somewhat in 2022 after kind of bottoming out in 2021. Retail trade has continued to decline. Educational services have taken a pretty large upward bump in 2022, I would imagine, with the schools being fully reopened. Accommodation and food services, flattish. Real estate rental and leasing maybe down a little bit overall, but somewhat recovered. You can really see across the board, it's a mixed bag, but we are substantially recovered, with really manufacturing being the big dog in this one. Commercial load forecast, I'm glad to say, is not nearly as exciting as the residential forecast, as it remains very similar to what we had last year. We've had some additional electric vehicles that we've added into this. We've also reduced it somewhat due to better information we've gotten for some of the new larger customers we're expecting. So the net has been about a wash with what we expected last year. I will also say that electrification of commercial is a much, much harder nut to crack. We will, I expect, be converting a whole bunch of commercial processes and heating and cooking over to electric in the coming decades, but I just don't have a good feel for how many BTUs of gas all of these various customers are burning right now. So this is a forecast that will get better than it is today as we go forward. Moving on to industrial, Boeing is, of course, our largest single customer. 747 production being shut down in 2022. We are assuming the 767 will hit a three jet per month average going forward. The 777X production was paused until the end of 2023 for Boeing, and they've reduced down to one jet a month for the 777 freighter. The 787 production line is currently vacant. However, we are penciling in that that line will be used for something in 2025 going forward. It is hard to imagine that one of the world's largest manufacturing spaces will be empty forever. So what that means in megawatt hours, here we have that same graph with our historical industrial sales going back to 1969. You can see the shutdown of Kimberly-Clark in 2011 being a big drop off. However, going forward, we have a few different things happening. One is the ramp up of the 777X in the future. And the last part, we hope, will be the plastic recycling plant in North County going online. If Tom Hovde were here, he could tell me if they've signed their new wood policy contract today, we were expecting. I was really hoping to have a hard answer for you on that. But once they sign a big check for us, I'll feel much more confident in predicting that they will be here. All right, so if you add up all of these sectors, from the bottom up, we have industrial load, commercial stacked on top of that, and residential stacked on top of that. If you look at the top of the residential line, that is our latest and greatest load forecast. Also there is that previous forecast that I mentioned, the dashed black line. And again, I would reiterate that for the next 5 years, we are pretty darn close to that dashed black line, but beyond that, things will be much more interesting.
Brian, excuse me, I meant to ask you back on a couple of slides back. You mentioned a plastics recycling plant. I don't know a thing about that.
Well, this has been
where and how and all that.
Mira Cascade is the name of the project.
Mira?
Mira. And they are looking to recycle plastic very near to the transfer station in North County. We are under an NDA with them, so I'm not super comfortable giving a whole lot of details on that.
Okay.
But there's information about it in the news. They would be a substantial customer for us.
Thank you.
And that's the industrial load.
Yes.
So if you could go back to that 25 more. So if you look at the slope or the trajectory we had from 1969 up to 2007, 2008, you know, we're not really predicting at this point a steeper, and I think that's due to conservation, because the interesting thing is going forward, we're electrifying more things. In the history, in the back, it was probably just population growing. I mean, you know, that's fascinating when you look at where we've been. Yeah.
I would agree 100%. Right around that 2007-2008, we of course had Initiative 937, which substantially increased our energy efficiency requirements to really reduce that slope.
Yeah.
Just for a little historical tidbit, in North Carolina, where I grew up, in 1957, we moved to Cary, North Carolina. My father was an electrician, had an electrical contract. We had an all-electric home. And we had a bronze plaque on the front of the house, and we weren't the only ones. That was in 1957, all electric. So, interesting, I think.
Yeah, things really go through a cycle, don't they?
And of course, we had an electric car too, which got obliterated.
Sorry to hear that. So going forward, we do like to break out all of the different factors that we include in the load forecast, just so we can take in the scale of each of these. So everything below the zero axis here is something that we expect to reduce load going forward. Well, everything above the zero axis is something that we would expect to increase loads going forward. You take the net of all of these things, you get to that dashed black line. So from the bottom up, things that we would expect to reduce load going forward. And in orange, we have rooftop solar. Red, we have climate change, which does mean more air conditioning sales in the summer, but an even larger decrease in winter sales. In each, we have new codes and standards. In the off gray, we have energy efficiency, which is the big reducer in load going forward. Above the zero axis, things that we expect to increase load, we have population growth being the big one. Commercial and industrial growth in gray being another large one, and in the sky blue, electric vehicles being dramatically larger impact than we saw last year. On top of that, in a couple of little slivers, we have indoor agriculture and air conditioning. Note on air conditioning is that while it is a whole lot of peak load, we really only see it in large scale for a couple of weeks out of the year. due to climate change, those weeks get bigger or there's more of them. We do have some assumptions for that, but in terms of average megawatt hours for the year, it's just not that many. All right, so next steps. Here we have a dramatically larger load forecast than we've had for a long time. So what we're going to do with it to make it a solvable problem, 100 solvable problems rather than one big one, is to break it down into our small area forecast. So what we're going to do is take each of the big components of this and do it on a feeder by feeder, substation by substation level. So we'll be looking specifically at air conditioning, rooftop solar, and electrification of both home heat and electric vehicles. We believe that based on everything we know about the customer, we can make a reasonably good estimate of how likely they are to acquire any of these things. For example, we know if a customer is in a single family home versus an apartment. We know based on their past usage, whether they likely already have electric heat or not, or whether they already have air conditioning or not. So a single family home that does not have air conditioning, you might imagine is much more likely to add it than an apartment that already has it. Or alternatively, someone living in a single family home in South County is probably far more likely to add an electric vehicle than someone living in a duplex in Darrington. So we can run the statistics on this, and I believe make a good feeder by feeder level load forecast that our system planners can go out and actually solve for on a local basis. We're also going to pair this up with our local distributed energy resource assessments, which we did as part of the last IRP. So that is feeder by feeder energy efficiency potential, storage, rooftop solar, all of these things that we could use to try to help reduce these loads at the individual feeders. Once we plug all these together, we'll use our least cost planning methods that we were used to, our integrated resource plan, and capital improvement plan, to go out and solve this problem in the most efficient way possible.
Does this not speak well for the foresight to what, 10, 15, 20 years ago in terms of the capital improvement standard of the system, automation of the system?
We're definitely
a backbone for
yes.
All this.
We are going to get much, much better.
Yeah. Okay.
I believe that's all I've got. This is a big one. Any questions?
Have no more.
Great presentation, thank you.
And you know, this is a very good presentation. And when I was reviewing this, in terms of some kind of a base when we go into the budget hearing process, this really does a lot to see as that plays out in decisions and in the budgets. It really helps.
It's an interesting time for us and that we don't see that big load happening right away.
Yeah.
And some of these projects are very long lead time. Even how long it takes us to build a transmission line or a substation, or even acquire land for a substation, we'll likely be looking at making some of these investments sooner rather than later.
And the other thing that's interesting is, well, I would imagine in the past, we knew we're building, we're going to get built. In fact, we use that as a prediction to help understand the feeder system. Now we have to also figure out where electric car, who's going to buy electric car, and what part of our district is going to be electrified for transportation.
Absolutely, and some EVs are much more impactful than others.
Yeah.
Just for example, my Nissan Leaf charges at 40 amps, which is 7 kW, something like that. Tesla might charge at a little under 10 kW. The F-150 Lightning, which is so popular, you can't even buy one, by the way.
Yeah.
Charges at 19.2 kW.
Wow.
I wonder how many 15 kilowatt transformers we have out there that will be under serious stress if anybody goes out and buys one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Brian, I know when we're looking 5 years out plus, we have this imminent load growth. And ahead of that, like you mentioned, we're going to have costs associated with that. There's always a lag in the revenues kind of catching up with the money we have to pour into the infrastructure. So it's going to be important for us from a fiscal standpoint, staffing and all of that, to be prepared as we go go into those future years.
Well, downtown is going to be critical. So you know where those, we need to upgrade those transformers and where we don't. A lot of unhappy customers. Their neighbors start looking at lots of cars.
Well, I hit one of my buttons.
Can't figure it out.
Planning for capital work. And it, you know, in recent times, special emphasis on town. Yeah, but as we're seeing, it is slowing down, but things are changing. And, you know, you can't build a substation in 2 days. Takes money, but it also takes time. Guy, do you have anything more for the morning session?
No, Brian, Felicia, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Felicia.
Yes. Okay. So let's see. It is now 11:19, and the meeting will recess until 1:30. We will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.